But do you have, well, how tall are you?
Huh?
How tall are you?
Honestly?
Yeah.
Good morning, everybody. It is March the 30th, and we are here today to hold a public hearing on HEC. And so I would open the hearing on House Bill 5024 for purposes of a public hearing and taking testimony. And I will call you up in threes. Please keep your
chairs.
Are there three chairs there? Please keep your remarks to 3 minutes or less. And we'll see if we can get through this list of folks we have here. Let's start with Ruvim Kondrastev.
Close.
Probably.
He said close.
Oh, there he is. Okay. And also Anna Escobado Barranza and Shelby Wolf.
And if you could move the microphone about 12 inches from your.
Yeah,
from
don't
your mouth, that's
yeah,
great.
Don't eat the mic. Keep about a foot away from it, and it picks up really well. So if you swing it over toward you, and then about so far, works great. Okay, go ahead and tell me how you actually say your name first.
Well, my name in English, my name is Ruvim Kondratiev. I don't know if you want to hear the original, but...
Yes.
Yes, please.
Sure. Ruvim Kondratiev. That's Russian. So I'm from Kazakhstan, but I've lived in Oregon since 2002.
Okay. So you were born in Kazakhstan?
Mm-hmm.
And how long have you been in the United States?
So maybe 13 years.
13 years. Okay. Why don't you go ahead with your presentation?
Well, I was just going to say that the opportunity grant helps.
And where are you a student?
I'm a student at Willamette University across the street.
Aha, uh-huh, very expensive. And are you a good student?
Yeah.
So the opportunity grants allow you to stay in college?
Yes.
Sounds good. Anything more?
No.
Okay.
What's his major?
Well, yeah, what's your major?
Physics.
Physics.
What school did you come from? What high school?
I went to Early College High School on the Schmeckeda campus.
Okay. Good.
Mr. Chair, questions? Can I ask you
yes.
a question?
Yes. Madam Co-Chair.
So, tell us a little bit more what your school was like, what you called it
Early College High School.
Early College. And so was that your third or fourth year or fifth year of high school?
Basically, so I went to that high school for 4 years. They allow students to either go for 4 years or 5 years, depending on, well, what they want to do. Basically, you do high school, and there's a possibility of getting some college or maybe even a college degree for while being in high school. So what I did was I took 2 years of math there. It really helps with the physics. And
college math?
Yeah, college math, calculus. So then basically I finished high school in 4 years, and now it's my second year at Willamette.
Well, thank you.
So you're about 20 years old?
Yes.
I figured that out. I can do the math. Well, welcome, and we wish you well. Anna.
Hello. My name is Anna Escobedo Barraza. I am currently a first-year student at Willamette University. I graduated from North Salem High School this past, well, a year ago almost. I just wanted to say that the Oregon Opportunity Grant does help a lot. I'm currently a full-time student as well as I have two part-times. Sounds like a lot, but one of them is only 2 hours a week. Just the Oregon Opportunity Grant really does help. I currently only work 2 days at my, like, 8-hour shift job. And, like, last night I ended at 1:15 in the morning. And it sounds terrible, but comparing it to having to do that 5 days a week and still trying to do full-time school, it really does help to have a grant such as this one. I'm really grateful for it, and I think it's a really great program for Oregon students.
Thank you very much. And Shelby.
Hello. I'm Shelby Wolf. I am currently a senior at Willamette University. I am a studio art major and a psychology minor. I started out as a neuroscience major, but had to have hip surgery last semester, so I switched to studio art. So I'm mainly a psych major, but a very heavy psych studio art major. And so the Oregon Opportunity Grant is probably the grant that decided whether or not I go to college. It has been with me all 4 years, and without it, I don't think I would actually be in college. I came from Oak Ridge, Oregon. I don't know if you guys know.
Home of the Billies.
Yeah, the Boonies. Yeah, and so it's a very small town. My graduating class was 40 students, and only three of us went to college, and two of us are currently still in college. So the Oregon Opportunity Grant has offered me not only to succeed past high school and have like ambitions past high school, but also have ambitions past my undergraduate. And so next, or the spring or fall of 2017, I'm going to probably go to Merrillhurst University and study art therapy. And so the Oregon State Opportunity Grant has not only helped me get through my undergraduate, but hopefully one day will help me further my education even further. So,
thank you. Questions of any of these witnesses? Thank you very much.
I have one more comment.
Yes.
As far as like other funding that has been provided for me and other students, yes, we have other like scholarships that are offered for us, but what makes the Oregon Opportunity Grant more unique is that anything past the funding that we get is loans. So it's not necessarily, I would consider it to be funding because we have to pay it back, but it's definitely a grant, and there's a big difference between grants and loans. Mm-hmm. And so.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you very much. All of you. Okay, the next group we'll bring up is Mark Roundtree, Joellen Delian, and Corey Bianchini. Okay, Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you, Chair Monroe and Chair Kahn, for giving me the opportunity to come here and speak today. And I'm the athletic director of Portland State University. And so I'm here to talk a little bit about the Sport Action Lottery funding and how that funding is used and how it is critical for us to be able to provide opportunities and access for young women across the state of Oregon to be able to come participate in intercollegiate athletics and also have the opportunity to attend higher education here in the state of Oregon. And so I know a lot of times this time of year you think intercollegiate athletics is about March Madness and it's about big time football and entertainment, but actually what we do every day is preparing young men and young women, along with the academic component by their faculties, is prepare them to be successful in life. It's to instill in them the qualities of hard work and discipline, and not just to get by in life, but to really thrive. And these grants allow us access to provide young women across the state to come to school and participate in that. Because if we do our job right, you know, with guys, coaches and athletic staff members, they'll be prepared to go out and succeed and be great members of their community. And hopefully those things we teach them through athletics and the things that they learn in their classrooms will prepare them for that. And if we've done our job, then that's the community members we're going to be putting out there. And so very fortunate to be here, to be here at Portland State, and I wanted to thank you guys for leaving me this opportunity. And these are mission critical dollars for us through the Sport Action Lottery to be able to provide to these young women and support the programming for them to have access to higher education. So thank you.
Thank you. Joellen.
Chair Monroe and Chair Comp, my name is Joellen DeLeon, and I am a senior on the women's soccer team at Western Oregon University. As a program that allows students access to education through athletic scholarships, the sports lottery has exceedingly impacted my life as a student athlete. With my scholarship, I have been able to compete in a sport that I love, as well as having the opportunity to obtain my bachelor's degree in communication studies.
And that sport is?
Soccer,
okay.
It was always a significant goal of mine to play college soccer, and it's partly what has driven me to pursue a college education. And although I had the opportunity to play, part of accomplishing that goal is finding the assistance in paying for this education. And so that's where the sports lottery came in. My scholarship has allowed me to attend Western Oregon, where I have played all 4 years, and while gaining lifelong friends, as well as teamwork and leadership skills. Additionally, athletics have helped me to stay focused on my academic work, as I have had to practice time management on a tight schedule. As a result, I have gained an incredible amount of knowledge, and I am expected to graduate in June with high honors. My involvement in athletics has also guided me toward a career path in sports public relations, showing me how I can turn my passion into a career. Overall, this program has essentially given me the chance to have a college experience and has already impacted my plans for after graduation. The sports lottery not only provides students with access to education, but it also supports Title IX as well as diversity goals in terms of ethnic and geographic and gender and economic background. But it also assists students in accomplishing their goals and pursuing their passions. So athletics can help students through their education and career plans. And the sports lottery has helped make this possible. Thank you.
And you got to be fit to play soccer.
Yes.
A little bit.
Corey.
Hello. Thank you very much for this opportunity today to be here to speak to you guys. My name is Corey Bianchini. I am a junior at Portland State University, and I play for the women's soccer program. I'm currently pre-nursing degree. And I am also supported by the scholarship as well. Without the scholarship, I don't know if I'd be going to school at a four-year university. I am financially independent and support myself. I also work part-time to make up for extra fundings. Being a part of such a intense program has taught me many life lessons, including discipline to keep up my GPA and to work hard every day to reach our goals as a team and independently. I currently have a 3.5 GPA, and every morning it's hard just to go out and know that you're working hard for not only yourself but your team, and to one day get to reach my goal of becoming a nurse, which has always been my dream as a child. I've wanted to work not only to support myself, but to support the community. And without the scholarship, I wouldn't be able to be there eventually one day. And I know I'm not the only one. I'm not the only female athlete out there with these goals and intentions and putting in all this hard work and dedication to one day be there. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for any of these young people? Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All I was going to say, did you ever have to compete against each other?
Yeah, actually, we were just talking about it. We're from the same area, so we have actually played against each other for club teams throughout high school and
And we're expected to play against each other for spring in a couple weeks.
Yeah, so. We're about to play each other. It's funny.
Well, it's nice to have you both here in this realm together. So
yeah,
thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's your graduation dates?
This June.
What's the day?
13th, I believe.
13th?
Yes.
Okay.
So I plan to graduate next June. So
next June.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have another
About
year.
About the same time, possibly.
Yeah, around the same time.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for coming down this morning.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Kyra Matthews and Emma Calloway. Go ahead.
Co-Chair Monroe and Comp, my name is Kyra Matthews. I'm a senior at the University of Oregon as a sociology major and computer information technology minor. And I'm here to talk about the Oregon Opportunity Grant. I graduated from Thurston High School in 2012 and grew up in Lebanon High School. I have a connection to. The Oregon Opportunity Grant has given me exactly what it claims to be, an opportunity. This is the very first award that I got after submitting my FAFSA and applying for scholarships. Coming from a background of not only low-income household, but of just lower-educated family, I didn't really have the support for pursuing higher education. It wasn't really an option my family had looked at for me or for themselves. I was left to figure out everything on my own. When I received the email about being awarded the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I really felt like the dream of going to college could become a reality. After graduating high school, I've been on my own financially. With the help of this grant, I've been able to keep a roof over my head and continue to get the quality education. And now that I'm a senior in college, still receiving the Oregon Opportunity Grant and accomplishing my goals, with the help of this grant, it's just opened up so many more opportunities for me. So thank you.
Okay. Are you an athlete as well?
No. I'm not coordinated.
I mean, you're so tall. Or basketball or something. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Monroe and Chair Comp and members of the committee. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Association. And I will first mention that there were an unbelievable amount of students who wanted to be here today. But in public schools in Oregon, you have to be at the first day of classes of a term. And so there was no possibility of those students being able to join us. So I'm here on their behalf to support the Oregon Opportunity Grant and how important it is to so many of our students. I would like to mention that it's important to students across the state. I think we've heard some really wonderful stories this morning. But one of the things I wanted to highlight is that we actually are able to foster education in whole institutions through the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So for example, there are about 1,275 students on campus at Eastern Oregon University. There's another 2,000 or so online. But of those students, about 712 students at EOU received the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So in places in our state that really are supposed to be the door to access, the Oregon Opportunity Grant is that moment where students feel like college is a reality, and it's that first opportunity where they see themselves in the classroom. And I think that the Oregon Student Access Commission and now the Higher Education Coordinating Commission has done a pretty incredible job of fostering the grant through many difficult economic times, but just to see that level of growth and to see students going to school, especially in Oregon, in our rural communities, is something that's really important to us at OSA. And we hope that you will find ways to continue to fund this very important program for Oregon. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that we have a number of students at Southern Oregon University and Eastern Oregon University who really do love the Sports Action Lottery funds and find that their college is a robust program for them because they're able to compete in very competitive ways. So I'd like to highlight that we also support funding being used in that way. Thank you very much.
Questions? You know the way to my office, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Been there several times. Okay. Thank you very much, ladies. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Yvette, Alex.
And if anyone else wants to testify and has not signed up, I'm going to put this back on the table. And if you could sign up, we'll get to you right after this lady.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Honorable Chair, Co-Chairpersons Monroe and Comp, and members of the Distinguished Ways and Means Committee of the Legislature. My name is Yvette Alex-Ascenso, and I serve as Professor of Political Science and Vice President for Equity and Inclusion at the University of Oregon. I'm used to going on for hours and hours, so I've written my testimony out to make sure that it's limited to the 5 minutes of time that I'm allotted. And so I'm going to begin now. Thank you very much for your exemplary service to the fine citizens of the state of Oregon, including your efforts to reinvest resources in public higher education. My invited public testimony is focusing on the importance of using equity as a lens through which the state of Oregon reinvests in higher education, with a particular focus on a continuation of the tuition offset investment, additional support for opportunity grants, and an outcome-based funding model that is clear, responsible to institutional differences, and which uses meaningful levels of funding to incentivize change. The research on these issues and my own experience as Vice President for Equity and Inclusion at the University of Oregon show that meaningful reinvestments in higher education are not only important for our state and its citizenry, but the equity lens is critical to help knock down structural barriers so that our students, all of them, are achieving in ways that allow Oregon to assume its rightful place as a model of student success nationally and globally. Now, within this context, I'll turn my attention briefly to an explanation of what we mean by structural barriers and why equity, in our case, initially necessitates a focus on race and ethnicity. I'll begin with an illustration about financing a college education. Most Oregonians, regardless of race and ethnicity, are faced with financial constraints in paying for college costs. You've heard some of that with respect to testimony and the opportunity grants. And that is because nationally, the financial constraints of our national and state economies, coupled with rising costs, present difficulties in making ends meet for everybody. However, for Latino, Native, Black, and some Asian students, the financial constraints, which are common for many Oregonians, are compounded by a legacy of racial and ethnic discrimination, which was focused specifically on these groups. Historically, it was encoded in the state constitution to affect political, social, and economic rights, as well as resources. So many aspects of these de facto and de jure policy manifested themselves in a variety of ways: unfair labor practices, irregular access to health care, good nutrition, unemployment, underemployment, rogue system of laws that targeted people of color unfairly, and an inability to access schools whereby advanced placement, international baccalaureate courses, and other resources prepare students for the rigors of a viable trade or success in higher education. These are just a few of the barriers that stand in the way of equality for many students of color in the state of Oregon and in other places in our country. And so while a history of racial discrimination is certainly a part of our past as a state and as a nation, it does not have to be a part of our future. It doesn't have to chart that course for the future. So that is why a focus on equity is very important. And rather than using a cookie-cutter approach, equity focuses resources in ways that remove barriers and provide a route for all students to be successful. It ensures that our students who have been undermined by racial injustices get what they need in order to be successful in ways that help them, their families, and the state of Oregon. A focus on equity can maximize the impact of resources spent on education, leading to better student outcomes and a better quality of life for all Oregonians. Your continuing reinvestment in Oregon's public universities will enhance our ability to facilitate student success at our University of Oregon Center for Multicultural Academic Excellence and other centers like this around the state of Oregon. Such centers provide holistic advising, retention programming, curriculum support, classes with small teacher-student ratios, tutoring, and professional development opportunities with a focus on students of color, first-generation students. And while the work of CME, which is part of my portfolio, is helping to ensure that our students of color and our first-generation students graduate at the same rate as majority students, our recent assessment data show that we simply don't have the capacity to keep pace with the growing numbers and needs of our students. Therefore, your reinvestment will help to ensure that all of our students are receiving what they need to be successful so that they can complete their degrees in keeping with the 40-40-20 goals. Finally, equally as important as Oregon's planned shift to an outcome-based funding model is its focus on these ends. If designed properly with the right metrics and institutional differences in mind, Allocated resources will actually drive innovations in research, in teaching, and public engagement that will help incentivize success for underrepresented students. Here again, the Division of Equity and Inclusion at the University of Oregon is working diligently to make sure that we innovate in terms of pipeline programs, faculty engagement, and student retention activities with the aim of facilitating completion. Most certainly, what we need for our continuing success are your support and your continued reinvestments to help scale up viable projects in ways that lead to a lot more success and to provide a pathway forward for all of our citizens so that in the final analysis, no one of us is left behind. Thank you very much for your service and the opportunity to appear before this august committee.
Thank you for coming up this morning. We appreciate your input. Are there questions for this young lady? Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I have copies of my written testimony.
I'm the State Senate's representative to the Commission on Black Affairs. So
it's an honor.
I understand what you're saying, and we've still got some fights ahead. It's not all just in the past.
Thank you very much for understanding that, and please know that I'm here to help in whatever way possible.
Thank you. Okay, is there anybody that didn't get signed up, anybody else that would like to testify on the HEC budget on 5024? If not, we're going to go to Mr. Cannon.
Mr. Chair, I believe they'll be working on day 6, which should be under today's agenda on OLIS.
Is it the end of the 30th?
Yes.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Shall I? Thank you very much. Good morning. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Great to follow on that public testimony from students and faculty at our colleges and universities, public and private. I want to begin by again, noting the letter that we've provided in response to questions that arose during our presentation on Thursday. We've also supplied a copy of the written version of the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. So if you have questions about any of the information that we've followed up with, feel free to be in touch with me or a member of our staff, and we can go into more detail on that. Wanted to sort of take a moment to describe where we are in this rather exhaustive but hopefully not exhausting presentation that we're making to you. We began, as you recall, with an overview of our goals and governance structure, strategic priorities that was reflected as days 1 and 2. We moved into a focus on affordability and really wrapped that up last week by zeroing in on the opportunity grant and our recommendations around that. You've heard the public testimony that's indicated here as day 5, and we're moving now into a day that I'll describe in a moment that's, I think, really unique and important. That's day 6, focused on post-secondary pathways and transitions. Later this week, we'll be inviting forward the community colleges for a description of their work and their budget presentations or recommendations. We'll have a workforce day coming up. That's indicated here as day 10, and then moving towards our public universities in days 11 through 13, and finally OHSU and the HEC agency budget on days 15 and 16. Again, the right-hand side of this chart, we've tried to sort of show how this work is organized into the HEC's various offices. And when you see our agency budget and organizational charts on day 16, you'll see them using these color codes to reflect the way that we've organized our sort of emerging agency into these offices, with policy and operations and research and data sort of threading throughout the presentation and supporting the work of the various office is focused on student access and completion, community colleges and workforce development, university coordination, private post-secondary education, and the proposed Center for Community Innovation. So focusing now on day six, let me just note, given that we're a coordinating commission, we thought it was important to really emphasize ways in which our budget and our work reflect our emphasis on pathways and transitions for students. And that's what today is. It's sort of unique because we're not taking a institutional focus or even an office-specific focus for the HEC, but we're rather looking at student transitions. And by that, I mean transitions from K-12 to higher education, transitions among and between institutions of higher education, transitions from the workforce to higher education, and from higher education back to the workforce, and we'll get quite a bit more of that on day 10 as well. So before looking at sort of the sectors, community colleges, universities, we really wanted to focus in on the pathways. So included in the descriptions that you'll hear today will be pre-college outreach, ways in which our organization is supporting students in accessing college, not just the affordability pieces that you've heard about previously, but guidance and counseling and support through Aspire and some related programs that we're in the process of running. We'll touch on some of the accelerated learning work that I know many of you are familiar with that our colleges and universities are participating in and supporting. We'll talk about academic transitions from institution to institution. The question that arose last Thursday around dual enrollment or students who are simultaneously enrolled in community colleges and universities through agreements between those institutions. And we will talk eventually about the career and post-secondary training programs that also are on-ramps to higher education from the workforce and are off-ramps from higher education back to the workforce. So with that, we'll start with the first of those items, pre-college and outreach. I'll invite Bob Brew back to lead this portion of the presentation.
Good morning again.
Good morning, Chairman Roach, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee. Thank you very much. Once again, my name for the record is Bob Brew. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, also known as OSAC. Thank you. So first of all, under this topic, I'm going to talk a little bit about Aspire. This is our budget for Aspire. We're primarily general funded. This last year, we applied for and received a College Access Challenge Grant, which was a serious infusion of some capital for us to do some expansion during the second year of the biennium. For those of you unfamiliar with Aspire provides one-to-one and group mentoring to students to talk to them about their possibilities and future aspirations for life after high school. The program welcomes all students. It's purely voluntary. Folks can come in at any time, and the mentoring is at the high school level particularly is tailored specifically to the needs of the student. Some volunteers meet with their students very frequently, some only a few times depending on what they need. And I'll talk to this in just a minute, but we now have Aspire in middle schools, high schools, colleges, community-based organizations. Before I go on, I'd like to introduce Lori Ellis. She's the Aspire director and can speak to this much more eloquently than I can, but I'll do my best. Currently, we have the slide is actually out of date now. We actually have 149 sites in middle schools, high schools, colleges, and community-based organizations, and we've just signed agreements with Salem Kaiser, so that number will now be 169 sites. In 2014-15, we trained nearly 1,600 adults and mentored nearly 9,400 students.
Bob, Aspire is designed primarily for students that maybe otherwise without it wouldn't end up going to college. Is that correct?
Well, it's designed to be, I guess, the whatever the student needs it to be. So in some schools, very much so. It's very much for students that otherwise wouldn't go to college. They either don't have the support system or family history. Tell them for other students, it's someone to remind them, hey, you need to get this form filed and so on. So it kind of takes students where they are and gives them whatever levels of support that they need.
And those 149 schools, are those in rural as well as urban areas?
Yes. So Aspire originally started in rural Oregon with grants. And so we're still very strong in rural Oregon, but we are expanding, as I just mentioned, into more urban areas that have their own unique challenges. And as I just mentioned, Salem-Keizer.
Senator Roblin.
Just a point on that. At Marshfield High School, when I was principal, we started Aspire. And my youngest daughter was, her Aspire person at our high school was Kathy McEwen, who currently is the state representative from that same district, but at the time was one of the Aspire volunteers, eventually worked for Aspire. So at our schools, it was for every student in the high school. We had a big push at sophomore level and then a really big push at the senior level, but it was every kid that was there. So it was open to all of them. We found volunteers to make it happen. So it wasn't about whether they were going to college or weren't. We wanted every kid to have the opportunity to look at it and see it. And I will tell you that for parents who did go to college and had a daughter who was planning on going to college, it was really helpful because you don't understand all the things, even when you're a high school principal, that are out there and the scholarships, the other things that change on a regular basis. And our volunteers had a pretty good understanding and knew how to help kids find those things. So it's a pretty amazing program, actually.
Aspire is organized kind of uniquely in that for a state program, it's relatively pretty inexpensive to run because we have a small central staff, and then located at our various sites, we have a site coordinator who's paid a small stipend, and they manage a whole crew of volunteers. And so we have a very rich, thank goodness for the internet, because we have a very rich online training program that folks can access. We do an annual conference and so on, but it's a very inexpensive program to run, and it makes a real difference. We work very well with school counselors, but we also are able to go into schools that don't have a counselor and provide that level of access for those students.
And Representative Springer, weren't you an Aspire counselor or volunteer?
I'm still relatively engaged in the process.
And we're glad to have you. So,
since you called me out, Mr. Chair?
Well, I remember from we have been doing this for several years now with you, and that was my memory, was that you were very involved in Aspire.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. One of the things, and I doubt Bob will talk about this in his PowerPoint just because it doesn't feel as germane to this conversation. One of the benefits of Aspire that doesn't get talked about often is because there's such a laser-like focus, which is what are you doing after high school? What are you doing after Friday night's football game is the first question. What are you doing after high school is the bigger question. But the connection that's made, and I have with the student, that goes beyond just what are you going to do? How are you going to be successful today to be able to even have these as aspirations? And I've actually had some counselors encourage particular students to be Aspire kids to connect. And it really, I would liken it to maybe the Smart Reading program in grade school. It's about reading, but it's about a lot more. And it's the lot more that we don't crunch into numbers, but I think is the great value of kids. And I still know a lot of my Aspire kids
and what they're doing and maybe what they're not doing, and so you get to encourage a little bit. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah, and I think it's exciting that Senator Roblin's school had Aspire for everybody, but we know that there are vast differences in opportunity for students. Some students come from professional parents that went to college, and some students don't have any of that and are very unlikely to end up going to college without some additional help. And Aspire is a wonderful program that provides that encouragement, that additional encouragement, so that more and more of our students can end up going on beyond high school. I'm sorry, Bob, I interrupted you and all of this.
Thank you, Chairman Rowe. Representative Springer, thank you so much. The anecdote that I've heard is you ask a student what they want to be. Well, I want to be an astronaut. Okay, well, what are you going to do first? Get a pizza. Okay, do you have a plan between pizza and astronaut? Not necessarily, and that's where the Aspire folks step up and help them fill in that gap. And there are lifelong friendships that form out of that relationship. No child ever suffers because there's one more caring adult in their lives. So, Aspire is basically built into four different programs. Our traditional model where we began is the high school, where it was kind of one-to-one. A volunteer will meet with a student one-on-one. They might have anywhere between 5 and 12 students that they work with. We also have an online version of Aspire working with students that, for whatever reason, they don't have Aspire at their school. We have a middle school program, and this is a group class where students can talk about careers and talk about college plans and things like that. And I should apologize. When I talk about Aspire and I talk about college or university, we also talk about apprenticeships and all kinds of different opportunities. Anything beyond high school, it's fair game. And then we are right now in some community colleges and universities, and this is, I think, really exciting because you've all probably heard the term summer melt. You know, students that plan to go to college in the fall but just never show up. And the Aspire volunteers and site coordinators that we have on campuses can provide that bridge between high school and college. So we have great hopes for growing that program. Some other things that we do out of OSAC. College Goal Oregon we began this program in 2007. We're affiliated with College Goal Sunday, where we actually have day-long or half-day-long sessions at various sites across the state, helping students fill out the FAFSA, talking to them about scholarship opportunities, college savings plan, different things that might be of interest to anybody considering going to college. Go ahead. And we've also just this year began a program called FAFSA Plus. The federal government recently decided that it might be in good interest for the folks that collect the FAFSA in data to actually be able to share a limited set of that data back with the high schools. And so a high school can send us a list of their graduating seniors. We match it up with our FAFSA database and can report back to them that, you know, Billy and Susie have completed their FAFSA, but Tommy has some problems with it. It's not done, and Enrique hasn't completed his at all. So there's this two-way communication we can have with the schools where they can then actually work with students and help them get their FAFSAs completed. It's a great opportunity. We have 50 schools already signed up in the first few months, and we're seeing some really good results.
I'll just conclude this portion by noting that Aspire and College Goal Oregon and the FAFSA Plus work that OSAC is leading is one of many, many ways in which Oregon colleges and universities are helping boost students' opportunity to access and succeed in college, as well as connect with the workforce. We've noted a few others here, that many of which are sort of based at institutions, and as you hear later in the week from community colleges, and again next week from public universities, expect you'll get some information about at least some of these. But Aspire, College of Oregon, FAFSA Plus, important piece in this puzzle, and sort of a way that we systemically, as a state, are involved in this work. But so too are these really important efforts that are located at our campuses. So with that,
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a request, Bob, if you could. I don't think it's a large one. There's, what, 3-7 or so members here. It would be great if somebody in your office could get each one of us the contact names of the schools that have Aspire in our respective districts. And that would allow us the opportunity, if we so desired, to reach out to those people. And whether we have time or not to be an Aspire volunteer, it's amazing the people we can get to show up at the meeting and become Aspire volunteers, like your local CPA, your local hospital administrator. It's amazing they have a hard time saying no. And that is, whether we have the time or not, whether that's our bent or not, we can make phone calls, because we do it in lots of other ways, and say, hey, you might consider doing this. Because there are few programs in the state we get more bang for our buck than this one right here.
Yeah, good.
Chairman and Representative Springer, I'd be glad to do that. And I'll also give you a very nice packet of information about Aspire that you can share.
My comments, Co-Chair Monroe, or to Ben, I really appreciate you getting us the FAFSA. And as I looked through it, I don't see any changes for about the past 30 years. So it's consistent, and you have to do the same thing every year. So consistency does help make the process a little easier. But, I mean, do you know of any changes in it?
Representative Comp, I do know that Susan Deegan, who works in our Office for Student Access Completion, it works as part of a sort of federal review panel that looks annually at the FAFSA and does, if not make, then certainly recommends changes to it. One significant change in the way students experience it today is that virtually all of them use an online version, not the paper and pencil version that you're seeing. One of the virtues of that is that the online version uses, you know, sort of smart, is programmed to allow students to skip questions. They don't see many of the questions here if they're not relevant to them. So this, it looks longer in paper than most students experience it online.
Thank you. It's kind of like a shortened TurboTax.
Huh? Yeah, yeah.
If I might add to that, thank you. Madam Co-Chair, one significant change this past year, it used to say father's education, mother's education, and now it says parent one, parent two, because we recognize that many children come from same-sex families, and that was one the most significant change this last year.
Senator Roblin.
And I just want to say, I'm piggybacking a little bit on Representative Springer, as a high school principal, the thing that sold me on Aspire was it has by far, in my experience, the best training system for volunteers that I have ever seen. And it continues to be. It doesn't leave things for granted. It makes sure that people who are being Aspire realize that their job is not to be the friend of the student. They develop relationships, but the reality is you're here, you have a purpose, and you're doing things. And they do all the kinds of things that make principals comfortable sharing our kids, who we are very suspect to letting other people, adults, come in and have access to individual students. They do it appropriately. They show you that you do it in the school, no place else. You aren't meeting them for coffee. All of these kinds of things. That doesn't mean that they don't build relationships, because they do, but they do it appropriately for high school age kids. And I there's nothing that was more impressive to me as a high school principal than how the backup setup was set before they walked into the school to start saying, we'd like to help you with this program. And it's awesome training.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Senator Roblin, thank you very much. We're very proud of our curriculum. We're very proud that we're able to give such a quality experience to the students, but we're also very proud that we don't leave our volunteers hanging. I think we give them a very, very comprehensive toolkit, and we're constantly working at improving that.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, if it's your pleasure to continue, we are ready to launch a sort of substantive section here that we may only get partway through today, but it's focused on accelerated learning, primarily high school students experiencing college early, and academic transitions, the sort of connections and pathways between of higher education. And for this, I'd like to invite Salam Noor, who's our Director of Academic Planning and Policy, focused on the public universities for the HAC, as well as Jim Middleton, our Interim Commissioner at CCWD. I'll sit down and have them come here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Let's go for another 25 or 30 minutes.
25.
Okay. 25, Betty says, so.
Right. Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Academic Policy and Planning Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
And for the record, Jim Middleton, the Interim Commissioner for CCWD.
Okay. Jim and I will share this presentation, and we have to jump back and forth, so we'll ask you to forgive us for any interruptions there in the flow. I will cover the portion of the presentation that focuses on high school student transitions to higher education, and that is both community colleges and universities, and then Jim will focus more on the community college to university transitions, and then we have a couple of slides that we will share as we move forward. First of all, as we look, I just want to preface our presentation by setting some context for accelerated learning. How many of you are familiar with dual credit? I believe all of you, if not most of you, are familiar with that program. So when we think about accelerated learning, we have a tendency to think almost exclusively dual credit, which is a very strong and widely implemented program in our state. Actually, our state leads the country in that program and the opportunities that it affords to students. And dual credit means students have the option to earn college credit while in high school. So they're enrolled in a college course or a series of courses that have been agreed to between the high school and the community college or the university that gives them both college credit and high school credit. However, I want to emphasize that there are many opportunities for students to earn college credit in high school. So dual credit is the hallmark, if you will. It has a set of standards that are based on national standards that have been adopted by the commission. But there's also expanded options, career and technical education programs that are articulated, that are often referred to as 2+2 or tech prep, online college courses that are available to students, credit by proficiency, advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs, AP in particular is available in many schools in our state, and concurrent enrollment. So I just wanted to list the options that are available to students to earn college credit while in high school. Next slide, please. So as we think about accelerated learning, it really is important because it does provide the student the opportunity to get a jump start on their college education while they're in high school. Accelerated learning also, we believe, is critical to attaining our 40-40-20 goal. So although students get college credit, there are many benefits to the student, to their families, to the schools, and to the college and faculty that are participating on both sides, the K-12 and the community college and the university side. So the dual credit and the different types that I mentioned earlier provide an opportunity for teachers and faculty to come together to discuss content, to discuss rigor, to align their curriculum and instructional practices. And this is really one of the richest professional development opportunities that are available for both the high school faculty and the community college and university faculty. And as a result, students have access to more rigorous and challenging courses that give them college credit at a much reduced rate. And I want to underscore the much reduced reduced cost, because quite often community colleges, for example, will have a $25 transcripting fee regardless of the number of credits that the student has earned at that institution. And that is great value for the student and their family. So the student can take anywhere from 8 to 20, 50 credits, and it's just a $25 or a $50 transcripting fee. Students also gain a better understanding of college expectations as they get exposure to this curriculum and content. They receive support services from both the high school and the college that they're taking that dual credit course in. At, for example, it's often referred to as blended advising or coaching in the form of mentoring and supporting the students, and in many cases their families, to understand the expectation and what they need to do in order to be successful in college and how to navigate that transition. Most importantly for us, especially as we talk about equity, and you heard about that this morning, accelerated learning is really key to closing access, opportunity, and achievement gaps to certain groups of students. We hear of many first-generation students that have the option to take advantage of the Oregon Opportunity Grant and other financial resources that are being made available for both for all students, but focused on historically underserved populations. So many of those students could be the first student in their family to graduate from high school. They could be the first student in their family to go to college. And the accelerated learning programs and the college credit opportunities that are available to them give them a chance to really build their capacity for engaging in more rigorous work, to increase the belief that they are college-going, that college-going culture, if you will, in their family, but it's also in schools. And it really prepares them to make that transition successfully, and we want to see that happen, of course. So the notion of affordability, access, and equity is really integral to these accelerated learning opportunities that we afford students in our state.
Last week, we learned that many students don't finish in 4 years. They take 5 or 6. Well, the best way to get through in 4 is to have a head start out of high school with maybe 6 or 9 credit hours already in the bank when you start your freshman year. Makes it much more likely that you're going to finish in well within your 4-year time frame, and at a cost savings. We looked at how much more it costs a student, how much more debt they have if it takes them 5 years, say, to get their undergraduate, than if they can do it in 4. So these dual credit classes, whether it be AP or whatever, give them that opportunity. Yeah. It's what I taught for over 20 years.
Co-Chair Monroe, thank you so much for your comments. That's a great segue into my next slide. I think you actually summarized my next slide much more eloquently than I would have. So thank you so much. But I do want to stress that accelerated learning increases students' readiness for college and careers, I would say, because it gives them the opportunity to focus in on the different areas that they may be interested in and to see what that college course is like. We also know, as Co-Chair Monroe indicated, and this is based on two are national studies, and one is an Oregon University study that was conducted in 2011, and based on two different attempts, we learned that students who earn 6 to 7 college credits, which is the equivalent of 2 courses, are significantly more likely to attain a degree than those who did not earn credits. And Oregon students who participate in dual credit programs have higher college participation rates, higher retention rates, higher GPAs, and are more likely to earn a college degree in a shorter amount of time, and hopefully within 4 years. I also want to emphasize that students that participate in accelerated learning are less likely to need remediation at the community college or university level. As you are well aware, remediation has increased from 47% in 2005 to 67% in 2010. I don't have most current data to share with you, but I just wanted to emphasize the significance and the increase of remediation for our high school students. And many of them, unfortunately, end up going into developmental education. And we know that based on research and various studies, that students that go into developmental education, they have a lesser chance of actually completing their college education and graduating. So accelerated learning helps reduce the need for developmental education and also that additional cost for students and their families. So, so we wanted to share with you some numbers, and this is actually all dual credit. So it's all of the different programs that I mentioned earlier, not just dual credit. It's expanded options, online courses, dual enrollment, et cetera, from the 11-12 school year, we have a total of 27,346 students participating. That is total credits of 220,000 plus. On average, students complete 8.1 credits, and the average grade is 3.45. So this data further validates that what Co-Chair Monroe shared earlier in the slide that I just shared with you relative to how participation makes a difference for students. I actually have a more recent slide to share with you, but it's only from participation in community colleges. So this shows you the growth and the popularity of this program. And again, this is dual credit for community colleges only. So in 2006-07, we had over 19,000 students participating. In 13-14, we had 248,000 students participating. I decided to look up the number of juniors and seniors that we had in 13-14, and we had about 89,000 students that would be juniors and that would have been juniors and seniors that year. So based on this participation rate, that's about 32% of students, high school juniors and seniors, participating in accelerated learning and dual credit only. And again, this is just dual credit from community college, and it doesn't include all types of dual credit. So I suspect the number would be much higher. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jim, and he'll take it from here.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, committee members. Before I get into the specifics of the next slide, if I were sitting on your side of the table, what I would be pleased to hear about some of the presentation as we focus on HEC are really two things. A sense of things happening out of intentionality rather than just accident. There's lots of good things that happen between high school and community college, between community college and university. But I think part of the message here is it's being structured by a sense of intentionality. And I think I'm the metaphor guy, and I think what we look at of the very, very important role of HEC is seeing that somebody owns the bridges, not just the islands. And you'll hear a lot of discussion from your education representatives as K-12 talks about K-12 and community colleges talk about themselves and the universities and OHSU. But I think the very, very important role that HEC serves is to be in charge of those bridges and continue to reinforce them and build more of them. Part of the legacy from the former system with the university, Oregon University system, was that there was a joint boards articulation commission that was a joint board between the community colleges, you know, State Board of Ed and the higher ed board that looked at articulation. That now is still continuing and is reporting to HEC. So we didn't lose that piece. It continues to be active and really does that job of intentionality, asking the questions and looking at the systems that are proposed beyond a legislative or regulative point of view. There are numerous bridges between the two-year and four-year institutions. And part of it, I think, it does represent our regional distinctiveness. As we look at certain campus articulation agreements that are between neighboring institutions that are much more place-bound, the community colleges and universities try to work through defining, guiding articulation agreements that help students articulate and maximize the number of credits that are being transferred. You can do your enrollment in the community college, transfer credits, but if that's not aligning with the major appropriately, we can have some credit leakage. Being in this role only part-time, I wasn't here on Thursday, but while I'm out walking in the 73-degree weather in Bend, I did, you know, get the text that there was some interest in further discussion about some of the degree partnership programs. And frankly, I could take the rest of the day just describing degree partnership programs between community colleges and universities. And so I'll hit just a few highlights on those elements. And, you know, sent out a note to some of my other colleagues, and I think it was best described by Chemeketa staff in its overarching way, that the primary benefit of the dual enrollment in this between community colleges and universities is really at the financial aid basis benefit, because what it does is combines the enrollment between the community college and the university into a single pathway where they get one financial award. And a student has to align with one institution for their financial aid, and they could be half-time at two institutions and not be full-time anywhere. So the dual enrollment really assists the students as far as their financial aid applications through a home institution, and in most cases also then does transcripting at no fee back and forth between the two institutions. A few examples. Portland is very active in this area with dual enrollment, co-admission, dual admission to both institutions with Portland State, Oregon State, OIT, as well as a number of the privates, Concordia, Western Governors, Merrillhurst, and Linfield. They're able to work through a single application process and combine their advising. Their achievement compact data shows over 2,600 students who are duly enrolled at other OUS institutions. Portland State, PCC, and Mount Hood also work in the Oregon Metro Connect project, where they have defined pathway maps for 10 very common majors, mm-hmm. that really lay out then for the students what are the right choices to follow that path, not just to transfer to the institution, but to move within the major and support a four-year guarantee for them for their graduation. Lynn Benton, one of the largest programs in the state due to their close proximity and historical partnership with OSU, they have thousands of students who literally you can't tell which institution they're with. Literally within the day are moving back and forth in a very seamless and very supportive way. In the fall, there were 26% of the fall degree-seeking students were participating in that program from Lynn Benton.
Jim, they're treated as full-time students.
Yes.
Even though they do part of their work at the community college and part of their work at the university.
Correct. And then that really facilitates, as I said, their financial aid
systems. And the total cost of their education would be lower?
I'm not certain when they're doing the blended as far as how the tuition, you know, rates. So if they're a university system.
Community college tuition is lower than university tuition.
Right. And I'm, you know, not being directly affiliated with them, not certain exactly what the tuition, but we can look at what those are for how the tuition works as far as that's
concerned. I'd like to see those numbers.
Yeah. Those students also have higher GPAs than other students as they work through it. Shifting to one of our smaller institutions, Blue Mountain, they have dual admission programs with OSU, predominantly in ag. Again, working off of that, what's the tradition within the area? They see a high concentration of ag student in enrollment and have then articulated that program with dual admission. They also have a really great program that they call Quest, that is an undergraduate program in elementary school teacher education training. So the students enroll for their associate degree Oregon transfer with a minor focus in elementary education, and then there are EOU faculty on the Blue Mountain campus who then continue the junior senior level program of that. And Cam Proust shared with me a great story from that. There was a custodian at a Umatilla School District elementary school whose son told him, "I want to grow up and do what you do, Dad." Dad said, "No, you don't." Got him into the Quest program. The student went through that program and is now a full-time, in his second year as an elementary school teacher at the school where his father is the janitor, being guided there by his father to make that connection. So one of those really great real stories that comes through it. Clackamas partners with Oregon State, OIT, Portland State, have 400 students co-enrolled between institutions at any particular time, and are also working with a program with Warner Pacific that will also be beginning. So it's not just, you know, with the OUS institutions. My former institution, COCC, uniquely because of the arrangement with OSU Cascades, all first-year and second-year classes were through the community college with Cascades doing the upper. They will be moving to four-year, but still the substantial number of students who end up at Cascades will still be dual-enrollee students coming through that program. And then again, picking up on that theme of what is local, particular programs, the hospitality management program, which is a baccalaureate program at Cascades, and the outdoor leadership and recreation baccalaureate are closely bound to the community college similar programs as we work through it. Beyond the degree partnerships, the Oregon Transfer Module is a systematic transfer of basically the first year. So a lot of students transfer without the associate degree. The Oregon Transfer Module is basically the first year. And then, as I mentioned before, a number of areas where students have credits but not the right courses. So there are two associate degrees in business and computer science that have been designed to more specifically push the students in that path so that they can get done closer to 4 years rather than the five or six. So the next slide shows you, very similar to the high school to community college, these are numbers over the past 10 years, moving from about 5,000 students in those dual enrollment programs to now over 7,000. That's a pretty dramatic and pretty exciting growth as we look at it.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It's interesting that it's so, thank you for the information. It's very interesting if you look at this that it really was quite stable for quite a few academic years there. And then do you have a premise as to why it kind of, what, was there something in particular? Oh, actually, I'm answering my own question. The recession. Economic
well, it was,
issues
but
with
but
the
I
world
all,
at large.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner and committee. It was that, but I think it was also nationally and statewide the greater attention we were given to the importance of those bridges in smoothing some of these elements out, and that intentionality of coming back and building more systematic and better pathways as we look at it. But yes, it was very much driven by the growth. But you also notice that we've had a tailing off of enrollment in the last couple of years, and we've maintained that high level. So you don't see this dipping back down, you know, as we've seen the enrollment dip.
Thank you.
Good.
When we see the extent to which, thank you, this has impacted, just some quick items here that when we look at 13-14, over 20,000 students admitted to our university system. Of the new freshmen, you know, 57% of those were new freshmen, but 43% of those were coming out of our community colleges. And when we look at it as the 4,000-plus students getting their associate degree Oregon transfer, 47% of those were attending a four-year institution within the next year. So that's a good result, and with an average of those transferring 94 credits, 90, you know, is the base number. So that's a number we can feel comfortable with. So again, then final, you know, just giving you some more of those data points as we look at, that'd be the next slide. What we see, the block transfers, those are in three different types. The Associate of Arts Oregon Transfer Degree, 15,000 of those awarded. The Science and Business, more focused associate degrees that I mentioned before, 470, and a very small number of those first-year transfers. And I think this is an area we can do even more work. And some of the computer systems that will automatically pick those up, I think, will assist. And then other associate degrees, 760, and then other certificates. Those are the kind of packaging that students who actually moved on from our community colleges to the universities had.
Is that a logical place to break? Wherever you find a logical place in the next minute or two.
We got two more quickies for you.
Yeah,
two more
slides. Okay.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Do you want me to?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Building on Ben Cannon's comments earlier that we are a coordinating commission, and Jim's analogy of bridges and islands, one key function that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission plays is really coordinating, aligning, convening, trying to get us to think about transitions in a very systematic way. So these are some examples of initiatives that we're either leading with partners in the field, and that would be K-12, community college, universities, and even private institutions, or things that we're participating in. So I want to share with you a couple of examples of how this coordinating function is really critical to serving the needs of students and their families. And Jim also has a couple, and then we'll conclude with our KPM slides. So the Court College is a grant that the state of Oregon received to support transition for students from high school to community college to university. One key focus that the Court College has actually addressed is, what does it take for a student to successfully transition from high school to college? What mechanisms do we have available to us to gauge the level of readiness of the student? And as you may well know, the state of Oregon is implementing the Smarter Balance assessment, the SBAC. So one thing that we focused on is this assessment and what it means for the student to be able to transition successfully to a community college or a university. So through this work, we managed to get all 24 public institutions, 17 community colleges, and the 7 public universities to say and to agree, they actually signed the commitment to this goal, is that if a student actually scores a score of 3 or 4 on the SBAC, and they take additional coursework in their senior year, and that coursework could be college credit, dual credit type coursework, that the colleges will admit them without requiring a placement test. So all 24 institutions would waive the placement test and use those data points to determine where the student goes next. Another example, which is also a coordinating function, is the convening that we are currently doing with community colleges, universities, and our K-12 partners relative to a student's score on an AP exam or IB exam to determine what would be an acceptable score at all 24 institutions, and what that score would translate to in terms of college credits that the student would be able to get as a result of. Another example that I also want to share with you very quickly is partnering with OAIB around the College and Career Readiness Cross-Sector Collaboration. We not only contribute to that convening and bringing resources to those conversations, but we're participating in bringing together community colleges, private sector providers, K-12 universities to look at what we mean by college and career readiness. How do we foster that culture in our K-12 system? How do we help students transition smoothly without interruption? And how do we facilitate those bridges and linkages that Jim talked about between the different institutions, such as best practices, studies, research, et cetera? I'm going to turn it over to Jim to share a couple of examples with you.
Yeah, I'll try. Thank you very much, co-chairs, committee. I think one of the most important things we can do within education is continue to evaluate ourselves, look at what we do best, and address where we've got some areas to work. And I think nationally and within Oregon, some of the work we've been doing in developmental ed redesign is critical. And I'm really proud of the work being done by my colleagues in this particular area. There's been a comprehensive committee with representatives from across the community college sector looking at our developmental education programs so we can accelerate students through those, have those be more effective, align those courses, look at alternatives that are best for them, and also connect those with advising, orientation, and with first-year college experience, where often it's not just the cognitive element, it's other stuff going on in their life that we really building relationships, friendships, connections with faculty that are handled through first-year experience. Specifically, though, the last item up there is we look at math redesign. One of the things we've discovered nationally here in the last few years is that particularly math can be the black hole of education if you are placed two or three courses below the college level course. If you're placed at that level, very, very few students ever get a degree. They get stuck in that developmental math. They can't move on to other courses. And we have embarrassing numbers nationally and statewide. And so we're taking a very hard look at that. And part of that is when all of us went to school, our curriculum was based on assuming that all of us wanted to be physics majors because we all had pre-calculus in high school and calculus-based mathematics at the university. Most of us did not use our calculus intensively today. And what the math redesign, as part of its work, is to look at alternative pathways. So for many of our students, it's much more important that they have a statistics-based course than a calculus-based course, or some basic computational analysis skills rather than pre-calc. So it is truly not trying to water down the mathematics, but it's looking at the mathematics that is most appropriate for the work that they will be doing as professionals and as citizens into their future. So we're looking at very significant changes in that, looking at ways of integrating the math course with their actual collegiate level work and trying to do a better job more quickly in that area and do the work that really improves the systems of education for these students over the long term. And then we'll move to the KPMs.
So the KPMs, as you are well aware, is how we measure our progress, how we track our students' progress, and what actions we take as an agency to help ensure that we are making progress, we are making these goals, and adjusting our targets as we move forward. So these KPMs in particular focus on college credits in high school, transitions of students within a certain period of time from high school to college, enrollment in developmental ed courses, and the impact of that on the student. And we're very interested in continuing to gather data on these key performance measures and many others that we have in the HEC and the institutions use to continue to improve the coordinating function and the supports that we provide to the institutions so they can help their students successfully transition, whether it's from high school to college or community college to university. So with that, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, I will stop, and we would welcome any questions or comments that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. We will see you tomorrow. House, go pass a budget. Where are you?